So today I will be speaking with Joe Pavelka. He is an associate professor and coordinator of the Bachelor of Applied Ecotourism and Outdoor Leadership Program at Mount Royal University in Calgary. Welcome to the Green Majority, Joe.
Thank you very much, Dan.
So I picked up your article today in Alternatives Journal. It's called Turismo Alternativo. That's my really bad mangling of the pronunciation. Basically, we're talking ecotourism today. So I just first of all wanted to start off if there's anything else you wanted to add about your background.
Well, I'm an associate professor and the coordinator of the Bachelor's in Applied Ecotourism and Outdoor Leadership here at Mount Royal University. So as an associate professor here, I do quite a bit of work in Latin America, but also in Western Canada as well.
Awesome. So the article today that I was picking up in Alternatives Journal was written by you, and this describes a trip or a few trips, I guess, that you've taken down. You take some students to the Amazon, for instance, and one of the things that I wanted to kind of start with was that you start with some very descriptive language about the mystery and all this, the nature description. So you've gotten very, very detailed into that. And then one of the first things you start with after this beautiful kind of description of the nature of the Amazon is how incredibly difficult even just defining ecotourism is. I was wondering if you could just tell me a little bit more about what is ecotourism and then why do you find it hard to define?
That's a very good point. So,
or perhaps you might have to do it in the other order, I suppose.
No, well, you know, it's a difficulty that we have had in our field since its inception. So, and it really hasn't been around for that long, but one of the problems that we have within ecotourism is that it is easy for us to define ourselves theoretically, more difficult for us to define ourselves operationally. And, of course, we, like so many other areas, phenomena, I guess, deal with that greenwashing. So when ecotourism was first launched, everyone wanted to be a part of it. How do you decide who is and who isn't? It's very difficult. You know, how would I decide if I was to walk around Toronto or Calgary? You know, could I slap a green label on someone's forehead to say that they're a certified environmentalist or not? You know, there's too many shades of green.
Yeah, you akin it to in the article to the frustration of trying to nail jelly to the wall, which I thought was
exactly,
really descriptive.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So. Well, there are many, many different definitions of ecotourism, and in general, though, what we understand is that it is tourism that is sustainable and that supports local people, local culture, and the environment, as well as social structures, in the best way that it can. And beyond that, it's very difficult to attach numbers or any sort of quantifiable measures to it.
Well, we can,
groups have tried.
So we can stick away from trying to quantify it, but
sure.
just in your kind of your sense as someone who studies and teaches on this topic, just in your own kind of personal sense from your experience, what kind of proportion would you say there is the balance between maybe ecotourism that's hard to define, or maybe, you know, some stuff that's called that maybe that's not the right label for it, out of kind of a general either misunderstanding or you know, just things that don't fit your definition versus people outright actually trying to deceive and play and kind of greenwash and get away with, you know, getting extra business by slapping the word green or eco next to
it? Well, I think that problem was much more apparent in the early 2000s. I think now what we're starting to see is, I would say that it is not that common. So it is much more rare for us to encounter organizations or companies that claim to be ecotourism that are not. It's much more rare, much more common back in the early 2000s. Why that occurred, I could speculate, but I really don't know. But it is actually getting to be much better now. I think it's a part of the maturing of that sector, I think.
So, I mean, even just to kind of off the cuff of it, I've seen a few, you know, ads for some Canadian and some international ecotourism in the past. Over the past few years, I've just kind of noticed an ad here and an ad there on various websites that I frequent. And one of the things that kind of caught me right off, because I'm just kind of naturally a cynical guy a little bit, is that, you know, right off the bat, it'll say, you know, beautiful eco tour for, you know, $3,000 whatever dollars, blah, 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 blah. And then it first starts off in the description with, first we fly you to, and I'm like, already you've lost me, because I was like, well, it's not terribly to fly in. I mean, really, the eco thing to do is not to leave your home. So I guess how, if from the, we can, you know, put aside the people who are trying to maybe deceive or you know, somewhat play up the eco side of it for the for business practices, and we'll stick for now to the people who are genuinely trying to make a difference. Mm-hmm. When you're dealing with something that's kind of almost inherently unenvironmental, how, what sort of ways are these companies and families making sustainable? How do you make travel and tourism sustainable in general?
You raise an excellent point, Darren, and I'll tell you why. So in the article for Alternative Journal, one of the two families that I highlighted is the Huamani family, and the Huamani family has an operation in the Amazon. And I should tell you and your viewers, we have a really nice little film on that as well, and I'll give you the link to that later. But the Huamani family is a really good example of that, in so much as they have carved out this, and by carved out, they've staked a claim to 12,000 hectares of land in the jungle. What they're doing is they're running an ecotourism operation which is supporting their very large extended family. And their father originally went to that piece of land back in the 80s, and he, like everyone else, was going to slash and burn, and he was going to get into logging and farming. His kids later on, once they went to school and they started to realize that there were some alternatives, they set up their ecotourism business. One of the things that I tell people when they raise the whole flying argument, and I'll tell you, flying is not good, and I understand that. Flying has clear negative impact, and there's no way that I would argue that. What I do argue is the trade-off. When you look at families like the Wadis up in the Andes in Peru and the Huamanis in the Amazon, they will earn a living one way or another. They will do it. And the Huamanis in the Amazon are actually, showing a lot of other families that you do not necessarily need to slash and burn and set up olives or set up something else, and that you can actually run a business, a very good business, take care of your extended family, and leave 12,000 hectares of Amazon rainforest intact. In order to do that, you need Western money. You need Western tourists, because obviously they couldn't finance this via Peruvians. So here's the trade-off, and it's not an easy trade-off, but the trade-off is if you fly, which is not good for the environment, if you take part in activities such as this, and I don't want to narrow it down and be one of those sort of righteous guys, but in activities similar to this, what we're doing in this case is we are financing operations that actually keep this part of the Amazon intact. So, you know, it's a trade-off. It's not clean, but it's definitely something that I think people need to understand.
Definitely. And I think, I mean, another factor there too is that I mean, probably the proportion of people, excuse me, the proportion of people who are going on these types of trips, I would feel just kind of instinctively that the majority of them are people that maybe, you know, were talked out of a trip to the Bahamas and went to Peru to do ecotourism instead. So we're not even necessarily adding extra trips. We're just perhaps putting those trip dollars to more ecological use as well. So I think there's a number of factors. there. One of the things that you outline here as well was that between for Peru specifically, between 2003 and 2008, that visitors to Peru doubled. And you attribute this a lot of that to things like the Lonely Planet. And I just wanted to ask you, do you feel that, I mean, the numbers seem to speak to themselves in the case of Peru, but just kind of overall, do you feel like over the past decade, we've had a more kind of a general awakeness of people just being aware of the environmental impact of their actions, and then that possibly is a cause for the rise in ecotourism?
I think so. There's a lot of literature out there that would speak to the rise of consciousness in around life politics, etc., and how something like ecotourism factors into life politics. And I do agree with that. I think, though, you know, it is interesting, though, because, you know, me as an academic, I will often go down there and I spend a lot of time with operators. And sometimes I think I have the answers and I can say, yes, you know, guys, it's all about life politics. And then the operators will come back to me and say, actually, not at all. We see people who just want a different, authentic experience. And I think, okay, so, you know, there's a little bit of awareness. There's awareness in and around environmental issues, clearly. And I think the typical tourist today is much more enlightened than 10 years ago. Having said that, there is this insatiable appetite, I think, for the exotic and the different. And I think that ecotourism does represent that in some ways. Certainly not only ecotourism, but it's in that arena.
Absolutely. It's funny, actually, that I mentioned Barbados there for a second, or the Bahamas, because you actually have an update right at the end of the article there talking about some of the ecotourism in some of the, say, maybe we can call it more traditional tourist spots as well.
Yeah.
Some of the more kind of fun and the places you'd associate with sort of fun in the sun and going and getting unlimited bar and that sort of thing, a very common kind of Western vacation, that even places like that are starting to pick up this concept of at least in incorporating some aspect of sustainability, if not outright full ecotourism as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see, and I think that that's absolutely wonderful. So, you know, you will have purists in our field, in our field of ecotourism, who will disregard the Royal York Hotel in Toronto and say, well, you know, clearly that's on ecotourism. But, you know, those hotels actually do a lot to be more environmentally sustainable and more socially sustainable. And if a movement such as ecotourism can sort of raise that watermark for all of the operators to do more, then I think that that's absolutely wonderful. Are all-inclusives in Cuba ever going to be ecotourism? I highly doubt it. I highly doubt it. Can that sort of consciousness raise them to be better? I certainly hope so, and we do see that as well.
And I think, I mean, there's definitely, this is one of those issues where there's a heavy influence of the concept that gets brought up in environment and activism in general a lot, which is the concept of voting with your dollars, which is that not only is there kind of a benefit of, you know, giving less advantaged places where maybe, you know, people are slashing and burning, not because they don't care about the environment, but because they literally just need to eat. And to providing a basis for an industry where they'll happily, you know, switch to doing something that's less ecologically damaging if there just was another option. But there's you kind of mentioned the other aspect of that as well, which is that, you know, big companies and big industry, if they see that environmental issues, or that at least environmental sustainability is something that sells, we may have to stick on them a little bit to make sure that they're not just greenwashing, then that's actual genuine progress, but it's going to have an influence on that industry as a whole as well.
Oh, I agree. I agree completely. And so, more and more, what we see is tourists, especially, I would say with all demographic cohorts, you know, beginning in around 25 and older, but with the younger mid baby boomers, we are definitely seeing that they are asking more questions about environmental track records and even social track records. You know, the idea of fair trade within tourism. How do you treat your local employees? And are they getting a good wage, etc.? So more and more questions like that is what I encounter, actually probably in the last 5 to 7 years. Again, and I think that that's wonderful. I try and write articles like this and to do associated films, etc., to just get people to try and think about those things, because God knows I don't have all the answers, but that kind of discussion, I think, is a very good discussion.
Absolutely. So if people are interested in reading the article, we mentioned it's in Alternatives Journal. You can get that in a hard copy. They also have a great website. That's from the July-August if you want to read the actual article. It gets into a lot of details of the families themselves. But Joe, before the interview, you mentioned you had some updates since the article reading.
So I managed to get an AUCC grant, which is Association of Canadian Colleges and Universities grant, to send three of my students down to the Andes for the summer, and they are working with the Wadi family, which is along the Salkantay Trail, and not just the Wadi family, but all of the families along the Salkantay Trail. And the short version of this story is that the Salkantay Trail is becoming recognized by the Peruvian government as the alternative to the Inca Trail into Machu Picchu because of the growth. The Inca Trail really can't handle the growth. The conundrum is that once the trail becomes recognized and becomes controlled, as in you could only do it with approved guides, some of the local residents along the trail run the risk of being marginalized in this process where you have larger tour companies come in. We are working, so my three students are down there working in a community development manner with the families to try and get them better prepared, increase their capacity to put their own operations together and to be a part of that growth as opposed to being marginalized.
One of the other things that it kind of caught my eye about that, I want to ask you a little bit about your program, but the first thing that kind of jumped out at me was that I had never even heard of a program like that. We're here on the University of Toronto campus. To my knowledge, they don't have a comparable course there. How unique is that program, and what sort of, like, do you get people coming from all over Canada to participate in this program? What sort of response have you had?
Our program has been in operation ever since 2000, so we are heading into our 12th year, and we take 30 students a year, which is a very small intake, and we have about 110, 120 applications a year. Our applications are from Western Canada. We probably about 40% are from the rest of Canada, Ontario, Maritimes, etc. And then we probably have about three or four international students a year. As far as we know, it is unique to Canada. There are several programs that are similar, but no one has the exact same format as ours. It is it's a 4-year degree program, liberal arts based, and it has a combination of outdoor activity with strong academic and theoretical components as well. And then really, it's highly interdisciplinary. As the term suggests, ecotourism and outdoor leadership, highly, highly interdisciplinary. And that's the approach that we take.
Yeah, I'm working on some environment programs here at the University of Toronto as well, and it seems to be almost a ubiquitous implied concept that when you're dealing with anything having to do with the environment, it almost has to be a very kind of multidisciplinary way to look at it. I mean, I don't think you could really discuss the environment without getting into a wide range of topics. Pretty much every environment program here at the University of Toronto has various courses in various departments, and it seems to almost be necessary.
Well, I think one of the most exciting things to happen within the whole area of the environment, broadly defined, is that in the last decade or so, it has become recognized and acknowledged that it is highly interdisciplinary, and we're moving away from the dominance of the biological sciences, and now we're starting to move more towards the social sciences and even other perspectives. And yes, there are many, many other perspectives, but that is actually very exciting. And that gives rise to a program such as ours where we can approach these issues from a human point of view, from a commerce point of view. I mean, my goodness, to say something like, ecotourism and the whole commercial side and learning, proper business skills and marketing skills is going to help the environment. Was a little bit crazy a decade ago, and now I think it's much better accepted.
Yeah, if I can get on my soapbox for just a moment here, I would highly recommend anyone who's interested in studying anything having to do with the environment, whether you take Professor Pavelka's program here in at the Mount Royal University in Calgary or any other program at your local university, please take at least one economics course because you're going to find it very difficult to convince anyone who's not already convinced if you don't know a little bit about how the economy works. And believe you me, take it from me, once you do have a little bit of economic knowledge under your belt, there's some really strong arguments you can make.
I, Darren, I agree with you 100%. And I think, you know, the two stories that I have in alternatives and a lot of the work we do is simply about understanding trade-offs. I always explain to people that arguments at either end of the spectrum tend to be unintelligent. So if you are 100% environmental, 100% pro-development, odds are you will have an unintelligent argument. You start to get into the middle and you start to understand trade-offs, and then you can formulate much more intelligent arguments. And that's really the essence of ecotourism. It's not, you know, if someone wants to attack ecotourism, they can. And that's fine. It's really about understanding trade-offs and being comfortable with trade-offs in a genuine way.
Absolutely. Well, Joe, it's been a pleasure to have you on The Green Majority. I'm afraid that's all the time that we have. However, I would like to give you an opportunity to give the folks out there in Radioland a way to contact you, or if there's any other links either to your work or to the university, or if people have any questions, if you feel comfortable giving an email address,
sure,
anything like that.
So first off, I would say there are two associated films with the article, and they can find them by going on to Vimeo and looking up my name, Joe Pavelka, on Vimeo. And there is the first one, which is In the Shadow of Machu Picchu, and the second one, which is Manu Park, Peru. And you can find them there. And anyone who wishes to contact me, they can simply contact me at jpavelka@mountroyal.ca.
Awesome. And unfortunately, we're still having experiencing some website troubles, so we're not going to be able to put your name on our website for the time being. So just for people, I'll just spell your last name, of course, just to make sure people can get a contact of you. Joe is pretty self-explanatory, and Pavelka is P-A-V-E-L-K-A. Thank you so much for being on The Green Majority today, Joe.
Thank you very much.